us is Dr. Mark Jennings in his teaching on the Gospel of Mark. This is session number 13 on Mark chapter 7, verse 24 through chapter 8, verse 13. Syrophoenician woman, 4,000.
Good to be with you again as we continue to work through Gospel of Mark. We're in the middle of Mark chapter 7, and as we work through today and finish up in 7 and get into 8, we're coming close to the end of that first major section in the Gospel of Mark. You may recall from the opening lecture that Mark can ultimately divide it into 4 sections, but 2 major sections, and the first major section is what we've been looking at, and that is really setting up the authority of Jesus. And we've been seeing all the way through the power of Jesus, the strength in his teaching and his miracles and his deeds, as well as how his authority is in conflict with the authority of the religious leaders of the time. And we saw that even in most recently in chapter 7 when we were discussing Jesus' rebuke of the religious leaders and the process of Corban that they had set in motion, and the way that they had even understood and allowed to exist enabled, in fact, even encouraged the prohibition against following the law. By that I mean they encouraged a practice that went against honor your mother and your father. And we've seen that working all the way through. This next part of chapter 7, there's a change that occurs. And it's a very interesting episode between this interaction between Jesus and the Syrophoenician woman. It occurs in Mark chapter 7, verses 24 through 30. And I'll read that for you, and then I want to discuss it. Jesus left that place and went to the vicinity of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know it, yet he could not keep his presence secret. In fact, as soon as she heard about him, a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an evil spirit came and fell at his feet. The woman was Greek, born in Syrian Phoenicia. She begged Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. "First, let the children eat all they want," he told her, "for it's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." "Lord," she replied, "even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." Then he told her, "For such a reply, you may go. The demon has left your daughter." She went home and found her child lying on the bed and the demon gone. Now, from the outset, this looks like a typical healing account. You have the same setup that we're used to. Jesus comes into an area. He tries to come in secret. Notice he tries to not be known. Word gets out where he is. Someone who's in desperate need comes and asks for his help. There is some interesting aspects in this. First of all, thinking about where this is occurring. Jesus has left Galilee, and he goes about 35 miles northwest, if you will, to Tyre on the Mediterranean. Now, this was a place that was known for its commerce, was known for its trade in Phoenicia. Of course, there's a very interesting history regarding this location, the story of Israel. David and Solomon traded with the king of Tyre. The prophets also announced judgment against it, right, because of its arrogance and its greed. And during the New Testament times, this area is often spoken as one of the enemies of the Jews. So geographically, Jesus has entered into an area that is so Gentile in quality, if you will. And he's trying to maintain a low profile. So the place is very interesting. But this woman, which is also fascinating, this is a woman who comes to her, who is Greek, comes to him, who is Greek. So it goes, breaks through what might have been some social barriers there, both in terms of ethnicity and the separation between Jew and Greek, but also female and male. And interesting enough, to even maybe stress it even more, Mark Plakes calls her a Syrophoenician. She's under Syria, but also Phoenician. So that's how that term comes. Matthew actually calls her a Canaanite, which is a real old ancient, you know, term regarding the residents of this area. So she comes to Jesus, and her desperateness is clear. She begs Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. But what's interesting here is Jesus responds really first with a refusal. This comment, first let the children eat all they want, he told her, for it's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs. This statement, which seems at first blush a very strange statement to make, the ideas behind it has this relationship between Jewish people and Gentiles. So when Jesus talks about first let the children eat all they want, the reference would be to the children of Israel, the Jewish people, and that's played out by this idea of the dogs. And the dogs was a not an uncommon insult that was given to Gentiles, that characterized Gentiles. They would be referred to as dogs, in contradistinction to Israel. We see something similar happening, this epithet in Philippians 3, for example. The picture here, in other words, is not of a family pet, right? It's to be received as an insult. I was recently traveling a few years ago in different parts of Eastern Europe, around the Mediterranean. I was in Macedonia, Bulgaria, and into Greece. And one of the things that I found fascinating in moving through those different economic areas, Macedonia was poor socioeconomically than Bulgaria was, and you could also at the time see a distinction between Bulgaria and Greece. And you could see it in the dogs. So when we were in Macedonia, the dogs that we would see while we were there often were packs that would roam. They didn't belong to someone. They were scavengers that were in the roads, and they were everywhere. And they were usually very thin, very scrawny, very unattractive. They would get into the trash. They would operate in a lot of ways to what we might associate with rats, for example. When we moved into Bulgaria, there was still some presence of that in some neighborhoods, but in other neighborhoods you wouldn't see the dogs. And then we got into the parts of Greece that we were in. We weren't all of Greece, but the parts we were in, that's when we started seeing dogs as pets. So you could almost see as a place, about 10 years ago, as the wealth of an area changed, you could see the reflected in the dogs. And here, that scavenger dog element, that who roots in the trash and etc. That's the idea behind this. That's the idea behind this insult. It was in this ancient culture, it was extremely unlikely also for Jews to have a dog as a pet. So this isn't a positive statement, if you will. Now the question becomes: is Jesus being playful with her, or is there a refusal in view here? And it's interesting because there's a debate that happens regarding this statement. There's a back and forth. And what I find fascinating is almost in all of the exchanges of dialogue where someone, we're used to someone coming up to Jesus and challenging him, usually Jesus comes out the winner, if you will. But here it seems that the Syrophoenician woman gets the best of Jesus. And I think if we're reading Mark correctly, is that there's again this need for a muscular evidence of faith. That's simply coming to him asking for a miracle, that Jesus wants to pull more out of her. And if there's a deliberate purposefulness in here, even this statement about children, bread, and the dogs comes into view. And so the woman responds, "Lord, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." And I think the sense of that is she understands the sense of what Jesus is saying, is that he is Jewish. He's coming, to the Jew first and then to the Gentile idea, perhaps. But he's Jewish, and that he's here primarily interacting with the Jewish people. In fact, that's the mission he gave to the disciples. Like, they went to Jewish households. There's been hints of the Gentile mission, but it's primarily, he's mostly been around Galilee. And I think his response wants to pull out of her, to make just to see how strong she is willing to put her trust in Jesus, to express her faith and her desperateness. And so when she responds, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. Notice there's a very strong statement of humility there. She doesn't say, "How dare you call me a dog? How dare you present Jewish people versus Greek people in such terms?" She doesn't sit here and demand, "I matter. Listen to me. The value." You know, instead, she says, "But yes, even the dogs can get crumbs." And there's almost an acceptance, if you will, of Jesus' statement. And then he told her for such a reply. Now, and I think that's important because what Jesus typically affirms is faith. We've seen that throughout the Gospel of Mark, because of your faith, for your faith, etc. And so I think for such a reply, we're to understand that such a reply is a declaration of faith. That it's a expression of full dependence on Jesus and a humility before Jesus, a recognition of his authority. And he said, "For such a reply, you may go. The demon has left your daughter." So whether this was a strong debate or a playful one, the sense of it carries the same. And you have here then this beautiful expression. She went home and found her child lying on the bed and the demon gone. So the same, the immediacy of it. You have this expression of how what Jesus has done for the Jewish people who are suffering, he's doing for the Gentiles. And the Syrophoenician woman here gets a very strong, positive affirmation. And notice here there is not a sort of separate act that's done. There's not a different revelation that in having the demon leave her daughter, that joins what Jesus has been doing, with the people of Israel, the children, also with here, representing the dogs, the Gentiles, that he's doing the same to both. And I think that indicates that the separation of children and dogs, even if we can use those terms, is going away. That they're receiving sort of the same act of grace. And it's probably worth noting here that such a positive statement about a Gentile woman would have been very scandalous to come from a Jewish male. And so that this act of this miracle, this bringing out the demon from the daughter, that aspect of it is almost muted. When you think in terms of the other exorcisms where the demons have engage or discuss, you have legion, what do you have to do with us? And where the miracle, the immediacy of the miracle, be silent, the stress are there. Here, the actual possession is muted. The exorcism is muted. What is stressed is the dialogue between the Syrophoenician woman and Jesus. And so what Mark is hinting at is, I don't want you to just see the exorcism. I want you to see Jesus having deliberately gone into a Gentile area, now receiving and affirming and acknowledging the faith of this woman. That's the stress that we see. And then, this sets the stage then for this next miracle that occurs. And so you've got these sequence of miracles that are working through. And when we see the healing of a deaf and mute man, I want to look through this a little bit, beginning with Mark 7:31 through verse 37. Then Jesus left the vicinity of Tyre and went through Sidon down to the Sea of Galilee and into the region of the Decapolis. I'm going to, in a minute, talk about that trip because it's a very interesting geographic progression. There some people brought to him a man who was deaf and could hardly talk. And they begged Jesus to place his hand on him. And he took him aside, away from the crowd, Jesus put his fingers into the man's ears. Then he spit and touched the man's tongue. He looked up to heaven and with a deep sigh said to him, Ephphatha, which means be open. At this, the man's ears were opened. His tongue was loosened and he began to speak plainly. Jesus commanded them not to tell anyone, but the more he did so, the more they kept talking about it. People were overwhelmed with amazement. He has done everything well, they said. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak. Interesting as we look through, there's some fascinating elements in this healing. First of all, the healing of this man, he's both hearing and speech impaired. And the account of this has no real parallel in the other Gospels. Matthew 15, 29 through 31, there's a summary that would maybe bring this into it. But this seems really unique here in the Gospel of Mark. And I think what's interesting as we sort of look through this, this is occurring in the region of Decapolis. Now, this isn't the first time we've had this geographical place, this region of cities, this Gentile area, predominantly Gentile area. We saw this with the Legion, the exorcism of the demoniac. And recall there that the response to Jesus was rather less than hospitable. Recall that he had done this great exorcism, and here was this man who now was sitting in his right mind. And in the middle of this, the people come and they see what has happened. They see the pigs. Remember, Jesus had let the demons go into the pigs. Then the herd crashed over. They see all of this occur, and they ask Jesus to leave. And in fact, the now restored man desires to come with Jesus, and Jesus, somewhat surprisingly, said no, but did tell him to go tell people what had happened. Now, that was surprising in a couple of ways. One, that you would have thought Jesus would have said, yes, come, instead of telling him to stay. But also, Jesus typically told people to be silent about such acts, but he had told this man to go tell anyone. And it looks like this man was successful, that there was a positive Gentile reception to at least what the man was saying. And so if you couple what was happening with the Syrophoenician woman in this positive statement, and then he's moved into the heart of the Gentile area, into the spot of Decapolis, and he's got this huge positive reception. The best way to explain this positive reception, I think, is that there has been word going out about him ever since the amazing exorcism. The demoniac was spreading news and people were getting excited in a very similar way that we saw in Galilee. Now, I mentioned the geography is fairly interesting here. One of the things that's usually nice living on this side of 2,000 years from these events is we almost have no concept of the map. In fact, I often advise students when they're reading through the Bible is to have a familiarity, have a map with them so they can see where different things are happening. And if you look the way that Mark describes Jesus' travel in verse 31, he left the vicinity of Tyre, went through Sidon, down to the Sea of Galilee, and into the region of the Decapolis. Well, this means that Jesus travels about 20 miles north to Sidon, then southeast across the river, the Orontes, and from there he goes through Caesarea Philippi to Decapolis on the east side of Galilee. It's almost a horseshoe-shaped travel, around of 120 miles. One commentator described it, for those of you familiar with the United States geography, it would be like going from Washington, D.C. to Richmond, Virginia, by way of Philadelphia. It's hardly a straight, necessary route. Now, many scholars have said this speaks against its accuracy, or that Mark shows an ignorance of actual geography, or is combining different events. I actually think it works the other way, that the oddness speaks to the accuracy, that it indicates that Jesus was doing a very similar mission activity here in the Gentile lands that he did when he was in Galilee. That when he was in Galilee, he was constantly on the move. And here, in these Gentile regions, he's doing the same thing. He's constantly on the move. In fact, such a trip into the Gentile region to do this type of travel, I think indicates a purposeful inclusion, that he's wanting to go deeper into Gentile area. Another thing that's unique is the description of this man, that we have here someone who cannot hear and also cannot speak. And that Mark wants to make clear we understand this particular miracle occurred. Remember, Mark is choosing. Jesus is doing many, many miracles. And so it's not as if Mark is presenting an exclusive list. He's choosing which miracles to present. And it's hard not to think that this miracle, this healing of a man who was mute, doesn't have in mind Isaiah 35:6. Speaking of a time when the lame will leap like a deer and the mute shall shout for joy. When the tongues will be loosed and they shall shout for joy. Water will gush forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. That here there's this stress on the mute being able to speak. Maybe as also evidence that what Isaiah spoke of in 35 now is coming to pass with Jesus. There's a fascinating amount of detail on this miracle. Now, if you just think about how little was said about the actual exorcism and how Jesus, with the Syrophoenician woman, healed from a distance, didn't even see, just said, the demon has left your daughter, and then we get the evidence of it that she's lying in the bed and the mother bears witness. But it's from a great distance. Yet here, this miracle happens very differently. Notice what we see. He puts his fingers in the man's ears. There's spit that is involved. He touches the man's tongue. He looks up to heaven. He gives a deep sigh. And then he says, be opened. We actually get the Aramaic before we get the translation of it. This is the only place in Mark where we get there's such direct touching of an organ, with like the tongue. This is one of the few places we get spit. We'll get it actually, with blind eyes. But here, this use of this spit, right, where he puts his fingers in the man's ear, right? That would be like the deafness, and then he spit and touched the man's tongue. Such a strange response, it seems. Now, some have argued that the putting the fingers in the ears was to create an opening so that the demon that was causing the deafness would have a way out. That seems hardly supported by the Gospel of Mark. The idea of the spit has been discussed in terms of was it a magic device that would have been, that would have been here, and Jesus is a magician. But again, we haven't seen Jesus follow that type of behavior that is sometimes associated in the ancient world. Others have argued that this type of activity is what a Gentile would expect, and so Jesus is doing what might be fitting a Gentile. Interesting enough, though, the Syrophoenician woman seems very content with Jesus actually not coming to address physically her daughter. Honestly, in a lot of ways, it's hard to figure out why Jesus does the spit and the touching of the tongue. And I think we have to be careful before we put too much significance into it. I do think one of the things that it does show here is that there's a picture here of that which is in Jesus is making clean or making now work what was broken. That the spittle of Jesus has this idea of something from him that is now going to this man and restoring this man. And if that's right, I think we have to be careful there. It does give a bit of a sacramental quality to it, or perhaps even a foreshadowing of the blood sacrifice of Jesus. But again, I think the comfort I have is to say, on one hand, Jesus purposely does it this way. He has a reason for doing this way. He could have simply done it from a distance had he chosen. But he brought the person outside of the crowd, away from the crowd, and purposefully does something to the ears and does something to the tongue. And so even if the meaning is lost to us, we assume there was a reason for it. Maybe it was simply to do something that would have made sense in the cultural vernacular of the Gentile. The Aramaic that's given here probably is because of the stress of the memorable nature of this miracle. I don't think be open. I don't think this is some sort of magic formula he's stating. But it might have even indicate the memory. But it also draws attention, I think, to the fact that Jesus is Jewish. There's a Jewishness about him, of which he's now speaking Aramaic. And that is being stressed that even in the Gentile lands. You know, when we look at that, I think there is an Isaiah reference, which I mentioned. But there is also hard not to miss a hint of Exodus 4:11, where the Lord says to Moses, this is the context where Moses is not wanting to be the spokesperson and is saying he's unworthy and is talking about his speech difficulties. And the Lord says to Moses, who gave human beings their mouths? Who makes them deaf or mute? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? Is it not I, the Lord? So we have this mute idea. Jesus is doing what we've been seeing throughout Mark, of doing what God does, of unmuting that which has been muted. Now, when we think through this, there is something a bit of a change. Remember, last time Jesus did this huge miracle in the area, the legion exorcism, Jesus did not tell the man to be quiet. But here, verse 36 and 37, Jesus commanded them not to tell anyone. He commanded them not to tell anyone. But the more he did so, the more they kept talking about it. People were overwhelmed with amazement. He has done everything well, they said, and he even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak. You know, we've been talking a little bit about with the Syrophoenician woman how Jesus is canceling out the distinction between Jew and Gentile. Here, though, we also see the response of Jesus to this miracle, and then the people's response to Jesus also is an indication of the canceling out of this distinction. One, how are they acting? They're amazed. They're amazed in the same way that the Jewish crowds were amazed. They were amazed at the miracles. But what we're gleaning now is this amazement is not an indication of faith in Jesus or a right understanding of who Jesus is, but an amazement in what he's able to do. And so the crowds of the Gentiles now are very much in line with the crowds of the Jews. But also we find here this now command to be silent. So whereas before there wasn't this command, now there is this command. And the fact that Jesus is giving this command in the Gentile lands is not typically of what we've been seeing. Usually the command for silence happened in Jewish circles. And I wonder here if what we have finding is Jesus once again trying to tamper down an overwhelming popularity that is occurring, and that there is an attempt to try to keep the crowds at a minimum. And this would make sense, since we know that when Jesus entered into this region, even moving in with the Syrophoenician woman, he had tried to be secret. He had tried to keep his presence there somewhat unknown. I'd like to move now to thinking about Mark chapter 8. Mark chapter 8, again, we're now reaching the very end of this first major section. We're still dealing with Gentile lands. We're keeping a continuation of the story that's occurring. And I want to look here at the first 9 verses. It actually kind of bleed a little bit into verse 10. And you'll notice there are some striking similarities to this account with what we've had previously. During those days, another large crowd gathered. Since they had done nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said, "I have compassion for these people. They have already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them home hungry, they will collapse on the way, because some of them have come a long distance." His disciples answered, "But where in this remote place or wilderness can anyone get enough bread to feed them?" "How many loaves do you have?" Jesus asked. "Seven," they replied. He told the crowds to sit down on the ground. When he had taken the 7 loaves and given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before the people, and they did so. They had a few small fish as well. He gave thanks for them also and told the disciples to distribute them. The people ate and were satisfied. Afterward, the disciples picked up 7 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. About 4,000 were present, and having sent them away, he got into the boat with his disciples and went to the region of Dalmanutha. Now, it's frequently argued that this is a second version of the same event. That this, just like we previously had a feeding of the 5,000, now we have a feeding of the 4,000. And that what has occurred is a particular story that, as it went through oral tradition, became two separate accounts that then Mark has brought into his gospel, that they've somehow gotten morphed into separate events. And when you look at them, there are indeed some similarities. First of all, they're both a miraculous feeding. Both of them occur in a remote area. Both have the question, how many loaves do you have? There's a command to recline that is similar. The prayer and the participation of the disciples is similar. The words and the serving are in the same sequence. There's also the phrase, the people ate and were satisfied. That occurs in both. Leftovers were gathered. There's a dismissal of the crowd at the end and Jesus entering into a boat. So many will see a lot of these similarities and go, this is the same story. But there are some important differences I think we have to account for as well. 5 loaves and 2 fish versus 7 loaves and a few fish. And they're not presented in the same sequence. And even the language used for the fish, it's a different word. It's a diminutive form of the word in the Greek, and the few fish, meaning probably a smaller fish. Some have speculated some sort of sardine type of fish. The number of the people are different. In the first, it was 5,000 men, which meant there were even by more than that. Where here, it's 4,000 total. In the first account, the 5,000, the people are there for 1 day with Jesus. Here it's been 3 days. In the first, it was springtime. You had the reference to the green grass, which I think was a reference to the Psalms. Here there's no mention of green grass or any season. In the first, the people are put in a very specific groupings before they are served. Not in this one. The number of the leftovers are different between the first one and this one. I think even more important, in the first one, Jesus has compassion because they are sheep without a shepherd. Here, Jesus has compassion over the crowd, the gathering, because they've been there 3 days without food. There's no reference to sheep without a shepherd. In the second one, Jesus is much more prominent. Remember the first feeding, the disciples had come off of their ministry work where they'd been doing the same things that Jesus had done, and the disciples recognize the problem, the people need food, and they come to Jesus, and Jesus tells them to do it, and that's when they display an inability to even consider that. Here, it is Jesus who discerns the need. Jesus is much more prominent. It isn't the disciples coming to Jesus with the problem. Jesus is directing here instead of responding. I think all of this suggests that this is a different miracle. One of the things, returning back to this idea of oral tradition, right, the argument that you have a single event that has now morphed into separate. One of the difficulties with that argument is in oral tradition, one of the aspects that would remain firm were numbers. Numbers were usually a strong anchor in oral tradition. You wouldn't expect 5,000 to become 4,000, 5 loaves to become 7 loaves, 2 fish to become a few fish, 1 day to become 3 days. While different other aspects of oral tradition would sometimes morph, numbers were usually a strong constant, at least in what we've been able to glean. So I think when we look at this, what we're seeing is we have a different account. Now, what do we make of the similarities? Well, I think Mark is very purposeful in these similarities. Mark has been stressing the breakdown of the line between Jew and Gentile in this part of his discussion. He's been stressing that, both with the interaction with the Syrophoenician woman, but even in the healing of the deaf and mute, connecting it, I think, with Isaiah and perhaps even Exodus. There's been a flattening of this, if you will. And so the feeding of the 4,000 then also becomes a way to show the strong similarity of how Jesus is responding to Gentile need as he is also responding to Jewish need. So I don't think it's accidental that he has a second feeding. You know, some of the things too that stand out here as we consider this passage is notice this crowd has the desperate nature of the Gentiles. They've been with Jesus for 3 days and nothing to eat. You know, that's beyond sort of just being hungry. And now it's becoming significantly hunger. I mean, whatever food they might have brought with them, if they brought anything with them, have exhausted, and some have even come great distances. So there's a stress on their desperate need. Once again, the disciples show a spiritual insensitive, not being culturally insensitive, but spiritually insensitive. When Jesus is concerned about their physical state and the fact that they won't be able to make it all the way home in their current state of hunger, the disciples again ask, well, where can anyone get enough bread around here to feed them? It's frequently asked, well, this argued, this how could the disciples be so foolish had they not just witnessed the feeding of the 5,000? Couldn't they naturally assume there would be such an amazing feeding here as well? Well, I'm going to hold off answering that question just for a second, because Mark, I think, wants the reader to also be asking, how is it possible that the disciples aren't remembering, aren't gathering, aren't expecting Jesus to do a miracle? I think the way this is even structured is Mark wants us to be asking that question about the disciples, because in the episodes that are about to happen, I think he begins to answer that question. You know, here's where, too, I think we have to be careful about the numbers and putting too much significance into the symbolic nature of numbers. I do think when we were looking at the feeding of the 5,000, that if you recall when we discussed the feeding of the 5,000, that there were ample, I think, significant references to the story of Israel. You had the Exodus imagery. You had the feeding miraculously right out in the wilderness. You had the putting in orderly groups, which I think draw attention to God orderly, organizing Israel. You had the 12 baskets, right? Which I think 12 is significant in that context. Here, you don't have any of those other aspects. You don't have any other symbols which might support looking at the significance of a number. And so when we see 7, how many loaves do you have? 7. I think we have to be very hesitant before we make that seven, because seven is a theological number, before we make that seven some sort of carrier of other meaning, because I don't think we have a lot of evidence of other meaning involved that might support that. The similarities, of course, is everyone ate their full and were satisfied. And if these feedings, these miraculous feedings, have this idea of messianic banquet, of messianic provision, then what the feeding of the 4,000 indicates is that while Jesus' compassion for them is different, is because of their hunger, not because they are suffering as the sheep of Israel without a shepherd, that the result, though, is still the same, which is their participation in the messianic banquet, participation in the great abundance that the Messiah provides to the point of full satisfaction. That even if there was a to the children first and then to the dogs idea, what the children and the dogs enjoy are the same. The same feast. That here, the feeding of the 4,000 indicates the Gentiles aren't receiving crumbs. They are receiving still the full meal. And so I think Mark has purposely sort of set that in motion. Last little bit before we take a break is I want to look then at Mark 8, 11 through 13. It's interesting. This is very abrupt. So he'd gotten in the boat with the disciples to go to another region. And then all of a sudden we jump. The Pharisees came and began to question Jesus. So the Pharisees have sort of been absent at this point, but now all of a sudden they're abruptly back on the scene to test him. They asked him for a sign from heaven. He sighed deeply and said, "Why does this generation ask for a sign? Truly I tell you, no sign will be given to it." Then he left them, got back in the boat, and crossed to the other side of the lake. I want to think through this. Make sure geographically and maybe symbolically we're understanding the move here. We've left the Gentile lands where there's been this real positive acceptance. There's been hints of disobedience. We've seen hints of disobedience when he tells them to be silent and they're not. But there's been this great acceptance, the Syrophoenician woman, the feeding of the 4,000. And then as we turn back, notice the harsh distinction between the Gentile reception, positive reception, and the Pharisees. The Pharisees come back. And of course, by now, what do we know about the Pharisees? The Pharisees are not interested in really learning from Jesus. We've already been told, based on the restoration of the man with the withered hand, that the Pharisees had paired with the Herodians and are seeking to kill Jesus. So the sides have been firmly distinct. And so when we see here that they come back onto the scene to question him, which we've seen a lot, to test him. Remember, the testing here has this idea of trying to find Jesus, trying to create a situation where Jesus fails. You know, where Jesus falters. They're seeking to undo him. And so they came to test him and asked him for a sign from heaven. And the irony here is hard to miss. They're asking from a sign from heaven. You know, this idea of a sign from heaven, in other words, is probably another way of saying proof or something from God that would authenticate who you are or what you're saying. They're wanting proof of, you know, of evidence. That's not uncommon in the Old Testament, right? For the great figures of God, you know, that the Moses for being the key example, to be accompanied by such signs. And the idea of that a sign would accompany Jesus is therefore not horrible or dismissive. In fact, Jesus has been doing amazing signs that indicate, you know, who he is. His miracles have been evidence of his authority. He's been connecting his miracles with his authority to forgive sins, with his, you know, which only God can do, with his authority to understand the intent of the Sabbath, with his authority over creation with the calming of the storm. Again, those things that only God can do. The problem here, though, I think, is why authenticating signs are not uncommon as evidence of God's presence. They shouldn't be considered as definitive proof. Deuteronomy 13 itself warns against being deceived by the signs that false prophets do. The proof of a prophet, the true prophet, is that what he says comes to pass. And also, in general, I mean, you have an occasional exception where, for example, where Isaiah tells King Ahaz to demand to ask for a sign of God. But for the most part, to ask for a sign is prohibited. It's hard not to miss, I think, in this picture, this idea of testing, this idea of demanding a sign for authenticating proof. I think it's within all of this is I hear Deuteronomy 6, I hear Exodus 17, I hear what occurred at Massa, you know, the Israelites demanding God do something to show evidence of his covenantal relationship. In fact, in the temptation narrative, think of in Matthew, in the temptation narrative, for example, when Jesus responds, to Satan's temptation with, "You shall not test the Lord your God," that evidence was that scene was occurring where Satan was trying to get Jesus to make God do something, jump off the top of the temple because God has promised to send the angels to protect you, and he was trying to get Jesus to make God keep his word, if you will. And so there's this idea of showing evidence of God's presence has wilderness disobedient Israel hints. And in fact, I think these hints even become shouts, if you will, in Jesus' response. He sighed deeply and said, "Why does this generation ask for a sign?" Well, this generation, in a wilderness context, if we're working in a context of the Israelites, this generation is a common way of referring to disobedient Israel in the wilderness. I mean, Moses speaks of this crooked and depraved generation. And so we have here Jesus issuing this language of this generation, which he's already done. He's already been treating the Pharisees and connecting them with disobedient Israelites earlier in Mark. And so we have this generation testing language and the demand for a sign from heaven. And Mark I think, is stressing the irony of this, is that what had just occurred was a feeding in a wilderness. Two feedings, the 5,000 and the 4,000. Miraculous feeding, manna, Exodus story. I mean, how much more of a sign from heaven, does one need in terms of Old Testament language than what has already been provided? And so when Jesus speaks of this generation asking for a sign, "Truly I tell you, no sign will be given to it." That declaration of "no sign will be given to it" doesn't mean no evidence of divine authenticating miracles or events will be given, because there have been many that have been given, and of course others that will await, but rather that this generation will be unable to see any of this as an authenticating sign. That this statement, "no sign will be given," isn't about the actual event, but the perception of it. That this is judgment language. Judgment language that fits with what Jesus has been saying about the religious leaders in terms of being hardened, having eyes but not see. We'll continue with Mark chapter 8 at our next time. Thank you.
This is Dr. Mark Jennings in his teaching on the Gospel of Mark. This is session number 13 on Mark chapter 7, verse 24 through chapter 8, verse 13. Syrophoenician woman, 4,000.